Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Wednesday, November 6, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the Missouri Appellate Court vacates Ryan Ferguson's murder conviction. We'll look at how the local and national media kept this story front and center for nearly a decade, and whether that had any impact on yesterday's decision. NBC News is accused of checkbook journalism after reportedly paying for two stories, including some incredible video shot this weekend of two planes colliding midair. And for the second time this fall, there's a new 24-hour news network hitting the airwaves. We'll take a look at Fusion and see what makes this collaboration between Disney and Univision a little bit different. There's a lot more that we're hopefully going to get to as well, but let's start by what's making news right here in our own backyard, the case of Ryan Ferguson. He is still right now sitting in the Jefferson City Correctional Center, having been sentenced to 40 years for the murder of Columbia Daily Tribune sports editor Kent Heitholt. Yesterday morning, the appellate court granted Ferguson the writ of habeas corpus, saying that under the facts and circumstances of the case, he did not receive a fair trial, and the verdict is not worthy of confidence. And while our local media has covered this case with a careful eye since Heitholt's homicide on Halloween 2001, it has caught the attention of journalists across the country, including investigations on NBC's Dateline, ABC's 2020, and CBS's 48 Hours. CBS correspondent Erin Moriarty, an attorney herself, has taken a special interest in the case, visiting Ferguson in prison regularly and as recently as last week.
I'm just curious, what if there had not been coverage of your trial? Do you sometimes wonder if you had not gotten any kind of attention?
I almost know, almost certainly, that if you had not covered the trial, a lot of the facts would still remain probably hidden. And I think that was very beneficial to us in having somebody actually look at the reality of this case in a non-biased manner and look at both sides equally. Because before then, nobody had done that. You know, nobody had investigated this case outside of the attorneys, and, you know, it never spreads to the public. So thanks to 48 Hours and thanks to you and, you know, your staff, you guys actually looked at the reality of what happened in this case, and you reported on that.
So that interview done before yesterday's decision was handed down, but what is it about this case? You two have been here in town much longer than I have and have seen this unfold over the last decade. What made it so made for TV?
I think that there was just so many discrepancies in the case. The fact that you had witnesses recanting who were star witnesses when the trial happened. The fact that you had very little information, which is typically the case, coming from the prosecutor's office. And the fact that you had his father who refused to give up the fight for his son's vindication. And he continuously not only pressed the news media to keep it in the forefront, but he also pressed the legal establishment to continue to look at this. So I think that had a lot to do with why this case is still there. And when you have these shows like 48 Hours and Dateline, and they need content. And this is one of those kinds of cases that really fits into the format in which they've structured.
And I think the other two aspects of the case that really stand out for me, one, that it was 2 years after the murder that we have the arrest of suspects based on what? On one of the suspects allegedly having dreams about having committed the crime. So, and now, of course, he's recanted. So that was made for TV, too. There really was no physical evidence in this case that tied either Ferguson or Erickson to the murder. So it was all based basically on testimony of two people who, it turns out, probably lied about it.
And the thing about it is, I think if there would have been a more of a push on the part of reporters when the case was going on and when the trial was going on to look at the fact that the case was solely circumstantial, that you probably would have seen, I don't say a different outcome, but more of a skepticism on the part of it. But when you're talking about a journalist who in Idaho was a journalist, even though he was a sports reporter, he was still a journalist. When you have a journalist who's killed in such a heinous manner, then you have these issues with journalists starting to see some sort of connection with the victim. And that could be part of the issue as well.
I have to say, though, I do think that maybe we put a little bit of too much attention on the media's role in what has ultimately occurred this week with the likelihood that he's going to get out of prison. I mean, it is true that Aaron Moriarty, at least, took a very early interest in the story. According to Ferguson's attorney, Kathleen Zellner, she found out about the case from the piece that she saw on 48 Hours. But after that, if you really want to talk about why we're here today, I'd say that there are at least two people who are more responsible than anybody in the media, and that's Kathleen Zellner and the father of Ryan Ferguson.
So let's talk for a second about what we saw yesterday morning. It was always known ahead of time that a decision would come out on a Tuesday. It was going to be at some point in an 8 to 10 week span. We didn't know what Tuesday it was going to be, but I first heard about this about 8:30 yesterday morning. Between 8:30 yesterday morning and the time we're recording this call, this program right now, what did you see in our local media that you liked? What did you see that disappointed or surprised you?
Well, first of all, I have to say I thought that the local media I looked at the Missourian, the Tribune, and KOMU especially, and I found a lot to like there. I mean, the Missourian had very detailed coverage of the press conference with the attorney and the family. They had a great timeline of all the major events in the case. KOMU had the raw video of the news conference so that you could watch that online and see it. The Tribune had a decent first day story, but as I was looking this morning, I was a little bit surprised, especially given their connection to the story, that online, at least, there didn't seem to be a follow-up. Now, as this program airs, of course, their second day coverage will come out, so we'll see what they do with it.
I looked at the other stations. I looked at KMIZ, and I also looked at KRCG, and they both had substantial coverage of it, including, I think it was KMIZ, that went over to the Tribune and did some interviews tried to do some interviews with people there, and was only able to get one or two people at the Tribune to actually talk about what they thought about what was going on. So I think that they really tried to get a more holistic idea of what was going on, not just what the court said, what the attorney said, but also some comments from people who are close to Ken Heitholt and his family.
And KMIZ was quite aggressive with this story and their coverage of it yesterday. I remember that's where I first found out about it on Twitter as I was finishing getting dressed yesterday morning. And they were very aggressive in that they were going to carry the family news conference live on the air and online. That was supposed to happen at 4 o'clock yesterday, kept getting pushed back. But ended up doing basically a special report that went a full half an hour, providing updates, providing analysis. That's something we don't see a lot of in this market.
I hope we'll continue to see some coverage, because the problem with stories, in fact, the problem with this story over the past 10 plus years, is that the media have short attention spans. They go on to something else. Follow-up stories are not something we typically do very well, although there have been some examples in this one where they did. There are still a lot of unanswered questions. I mean, the most obvious is whether or not there's going to be an attempt by the prosecutor or the attorney general to pursue new charges, a new trial. We don't know if that's going to happen. But what about this notion of whatever kind of misconduct occurred there, whether it was the investigator or the prosecutor or somebody else? I mean, the prosecutor's a judge now. Be interesting to see what happens there. What about this whole notion of it taking more than 10 years to exonerate somebody? I mean, we see every now and then stories about these sort of innocence projects that have started up around the country, and lots of innocent people are getting out of jail, but sometimes it takes 5, 10, 20 or more years for innocent people to get out.
And that was a point that Kathleen Zellner made yesterday in the news conference, and there's an interesting piece in the Missourian today about her record, and that she touts that she has yet to take on one of these wrongful conviction cases that she has not won. But she said something yesterday in the news conference that she's working on another one in in Washington with somebody who has been in prison and serving for 20 years already.
Yeah, I think part of it is a larger issue that I think the media, that the news media sort of misses, which is why do we continue to have these cases? And a lot of it goes back to the, I think it's in some instances, the overzealousness of prosecutors to get prosecution in these high profile cases, because you have to remember these are elected officials. And one of the ways in which they can promote themselves at election time is to say, hey, I've won these high profile cases. I've been tough on crime. Well, you're tough on crime because you prosecute. But the question is, are you presenting true and factual information, or are you skewing the information to possibly convict someone who's innocent? And I think this could be one of those issues. And we've seen a lot of other cases in these innocence projects, mm-hmm. which demonstrate that prosecutors have sort of skirted the rules and not been as forthright in coming to the public defenders or to the defense attorneys with the information they have and the evidence that they have, which they are bound to do by law.
I can think, too, Amy, of two other stories that really do need to be pursued.
Yeah.
If Ryan Ferguson is not guilty of this crime, well, what about Chuck Erickson? He's going to be in prison for several more years unless somehow he gets the same kind of treatment that Ryan did. And in fact, Ryan's father said he was going to pursue that.
I was going to say, Ryan and Ryan's father say that they're going to pursue that.
And for that matter, if neither one of them was the guilty party, then there is a killer out there still somewhere. And you see lots of hints in some stories about maybe it was another sports employee of the Tribune at the time. But who knows? But someone out there did this crime and hasn't paid for it yet if these two guys are innocent.
Well, yesterday we saw a very big incremental development in this story, but it is just an incremental development, and we'll be watching it, I'm sure, for some time to come. Checkbook journalism. That's what we call it when a news organization pays for a story. It's a practice. It's usually frowned upon. But we are seeing some cases just this week where it has been happening. NBC has been accused of engaging in the practice twice in just the past week. If you caught the Today Show yesterday, you saw Matt Lauer do two interviews with people who were aboard different airplanes that collided mid-air over northwest Wisconsin on Sunday. The nine passengers and two pilots were all skydivers. So after the collision, they all evacuated and made it safely to the ground.
Some of the skydivers take their positions outside the trailing plane for their final jump of the day when disaster strikes. The two Cessnas collide in midair. Some of the jumpers literally slammed between the two planes. The wing of the lead plane bends around one of the jumpers and then breaks off. From a different camera, you can see other jumpers getting sucked out into a free fall. At 120 miles per hour, 12,000 feet in the air.
If you haven't already seen the entire video, you can on our links blog or on NBC News' website. That video and the interviews on the Today Show, NBC is said to have paid somewhere in the ballpark of $100,000 to license those exclusively. This comes on the heels of the network's disclosure that its news division is negotiating an exclusive documentary deal for about the same amount of money with the family of Hannah Anderson. You may remember her. She's the teenage girl who was kidnapped this summer by a family friend who was also accused of killing her mother and brother. So there's an unwritten rule in our profession. You don't do this. You don't pay for access.
You know, I have to say it's interesting to watch how NBC is sort of skirting that rule, because we don't pay for interviews. Well, OK, so they said they were paying for the video, although some of the skydivers said, well, yes, and also for exclusive access to us on the air. You saw that the GMA, Good Morning America, mm-hmm. they were bidding for the video because it was perfectly OK for them somehow to pay for that. But when they, quote, heard that interviews were involved, too, they allegedly backed out. That may or may not be true, but that's a pretty interesting line when you say these days that a lot of news is visual, at least the hook to get people in. So why should it be any different to pay for video than to pay for the words that people are going to tell you about the video?
Well, I think what's happening here is the fact that you have these news organizations who are They're in competition to have their programs be number one. And the Today Show was the longtime leader in the morning show programs. And now it's number two behind Good Morning America. And if you can get this kind of news and this kind of video, you're more likely to get eyeballs. And that's what they're looking for here. And if you have to pay $100,000, that's what, less than a 30-second commercial?
Yeah, but so that's also one investigative reporter.
Yeah, well, this is true.
I have to say, though, I have a little bit less trouble with them competing for the video, or at least the people asking to be paid. It's their video. If
this is true.
If networks
want to
pay, that's fine. Yeah. My problem was the fact that this occurred during the middle of our November sweeps period, a ratings period for television all around the country. And conveniently, the payment apparently also says you will not appear on any other TV broadcast for 2 more weeks when the sweeps period is over.
Well, I mean, part of it is, you know, it's going to the highest bidder. And I'm sure that they thought about taking it to ABC or CBS, and maybe NBC gave them the best price for what they wanted. And there's some stipulations there. So, you know, it's the highest bidder mentality here going.
You mentioned the other case too, Amy, and that's the fact that NBC just earlier in the week they've been outed as having paid or getting ready to pay Hannah Anderson, a young woman whose mother and brother were killed, and she was kidnapped by a guy who the cops finally killed, right? All of that. Well, they're paying her $100,000 or some such. But again, they say it's for sort of family mementos and other visual elements, not for, you know, the interview. And I find that line very, very thin.
But then you also have the exclusive right thing. And I think that's what's really sort of have journalists going, wait a minute, this is kind of on the edge of what we call appropriate ethical behavior as set down by the Society of Professional Journalists. So you're sort of skirting that line because you're saying, well, we're going to pay you this much money, but you can't talk to this journalism outlet or that journalism outlet. Now, all of a sudden, it's sort of pay as you go kind of journalism. And that could bring up a lot of ethical issues down the line.
Don't you imagine that if one of the networks had not paid for it, that certainly Gawker or BuzzFeed or TMZ or somebody would have paid for it?
Somebody would have. Yeah. Well, photojournalism is changing, and there are a lot of changes expected to come relatively soon at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. After a series of job cuts, the photographers there are expected to be given job title changes and become multimedia visual journalists. A spokesman told NetNewsCheck's Lou Carlozzo that the newspaper and its website will be expected to provide video and engage with the audience through social media apps and any other products that might come along. So kind of couching the other duties as assigned as technology might change. Are we beginning to see the end of photojournalism?
I wouldn't necessarily say you're seeing the end of photojournalism. I think it's changing. I think that you still have the need for visuals. And I think the role that photojournalism is going to play in how we produce the news and how people consume the news is changing. It's going to become more video. It's become more digital. I think you're still going to have stills, because I think it shows a certain aspect of a story that you don't necessarily see in the video and you can't capture in words. But I think that it's going to become more entrepreneurial. It's going to be more of a by contract, more of a freelance kind of operation, as opposed to actually having a staff.
Yeah, I think at least in terms of traditional news organizations, that job of still photographer as a single source job description, no, we're not going to see too much of that for much longer, because professional photographers have to take video. They have to know how to incorporate that into multimedia packages. That's just the way the world works now, and that's the kind of content that people want to consume. So I'm a little bit divided about that, because I do think in some ways, when you see some of these newspaper companies laying off some or all of their photojournalists, that it is true that it reflects, in a certain extent, a bias toward the people who take pictures versus those who write words. And that's always been true. But I also think that you see some photojournalists who, not all, maybe not even many of them, but some of them, who really aren't getting on board with the way the world works. They don't want to take video training, or they're not very good at video training. They're not willing to acknowledge that some day-to-day news coverage can be handled by reporters or even citizens, and that maybe they need to focus on what really adds value to their news organization.
Well, so this follows a model put in place in 2010 at the Cox-owned Dayton Daily News, Cox also owning the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And it's interesting because that paper made some headlines this week, too, the Dayton Daily News. It published a Wire story that originated in the Minneapolis Star Tribune grading the new fall TV season. And it gave CBS a C for its primetime lineup. That's a grade that didn't sit so well with management of WHIO, the Cox television station that operates a converged newsroom with the Daily News. And WHIO is a CBS affiliate. There was a memo that went out to people in the newsroom, to editorial employees, saying the newspaper would no longer be publishing stories or shouldn't be publishing stories critical of CBS. Is this where cross-ownership gets messy?
I'm not sure whether it's cross-ownership that's getting messy or you have maybe an overzealous editor who's thinking that we need to protect our brand and not realizing that by sending out a memo like this, you're doing more harm to your brand than good across the board. And not only the television station, which you have cross-ownership with, but definitely the newspaper and the people who work in that newspaper who feel as if, you know, there needs to be some autonomy between the two entities.
Whether this is an outlier or not, a lot of people see this and they're going to say, this is exactly what I suspect goes on in these kinds of situations. And it was pretty ham-handed to put it in a memo, first of all. And then when Jim Romanesco, the media writer, asked them for comment, the editors, about it, they said, we have always given balanced coverage to entertainment, but didn't answer the question, what about your memo saying in the future you won't allow this to occur? So they really handled it poorly all the way around.
Yeah. There needs to be, if you're going to have somewhat of a cross pollination of news and content and that sort of thing, I think there needs to be some standard policies on when we're going to work together and when we're going to not work together, and how are we going to be able to deal with that in terms of promotion, branding, as well as providing news and content to our viewers.
Because there are some times as journalists, if we're serving our community, that we need to act independently from
exactly.
one another.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of CBS News, folks on the network level say they're standing by a story that aired a week ago Sunday on 60 Minutes about the Benghazi attacks. Ernest, tell us what went on here.
Well, I'm not quite sure exactly what's going on here, but the whole Benghazi situation has really gotten out of hand, and it's mainly still being fueled by the congressmen or senators who are still looking at this. And 60 Minutes has done a lot of coverage on Benghazi, and some of the senators are trying to use some of that coverage to their advantage, and then they're trying to also sort of chastise the media, the president, the administration for not keeping the story going. And so I think it's one of those things where the media has gotten involved in a power play among politicians to try to keep the story going. That's my take on it.
I guess my biggest critique is that I do think that some of the folks who criticize the media for not providing enough and enough balanced coverage of the Benghazi attacks from the get-go are probably right. I mean, so Fox News takes over and beats the heck out of it on their channel, which gives other media the idea that, well, we don't have to touch this story. Mm-hmm. Here we are a year later, and Laura Logan is doing a 20-some minute piece on 60 Minutes that's based, she says, on a year worth of reporting, but also clearly on a lot having to do with a book coming out from a single source who may have been there and may have not in the way that he described it on the air. So it's hard to know at this point in time whether or not we're ever going to get enough balanced coverage of this story to be able to put it in historical perspective.
I mean, and the problem is that, you know, you still have Senate and House investigators that are still looking at this, and they all have their axe to grind as well. And it goes back to what Mike was saying. It's going to take some time before we really know what happens. And it may be sometime in the next presidential administration before we start to get really some in-depth information about what occurred and what happened.
But I do think we have to, when we start talking these days about, well, we're just giving grist for politicians or letting, they have an axe. Everybody has an axe to grind in every kind of story where there's a controversy. It's our job as journalists to take that information and put it into perspective, not to ignore the stories because we might be furthering somebody else's agenda.
So, Mike, you brought up the book. That is one point Laura Logan is conceding here, is that perhaps she wasn't transparent transparent enough in the piece that that book is being published by the same parent company that owns CBS, and that needed to be a little bit clearer. And that's something 60 Minutes has been chastised and called out.
Well, and it's not just been 60 Minutes. It's a lot of news programs that are running stories that are based on books that their reporters are doing. I mean, the New York Times does it as well. And I think that that's something that really needs to be looked at in terms of journalists being a lot more proactive about letting the audience know that they have another motive there. They're serving another audience, which is people who might be interested in buying their books.
Okay. Well, it wasn't all that long ago that we were talking about the launch of Al Jazeera America, the newest 24-hour cable news network. Well, it's not the newest anymore. Say hello to Fusion.
We've got singing, we've got dancing, we've got everything we need except for you. We're Fusion, the corporate godchild.
It's a bit more like Glee than it does a news network, but that's kind of what the folks at Disney and Univision are banking on. Fusion is trying to attract an audience of Latino millennials, second and third generation folks who are native English speakers, less interested in Spanish language television. It's an interesting strategy when you figure that Disney and ABC properties were among the first to use SAP for dual language programming on TV. Is it something you guys think could work?
When I first saw it, I have to admit, I just cracked up. I just started laughing. I'm a traditionalist, so it doesn't really connect with me. I'm sure that they did a lot of focus group, a lot of research before they launched this. What I'm wondering is that how long will this sort of rah-rah news operation last before they have to cover something that's very serious, and they have to be serious in covering it. Then we'll see whether or not this is actually going to work. That's just my initial take on it.
Obviously, I am not part of the target demographic they're trying to reach. And so when they do something schmaltzy like that, and say that that's humor and that it's targeted to 18 to 34-year-olds, I don't know if 18 to 34-year-olds will find that funny. I think doing humor, especially humor around the news, is very hard to do. That's why there are only a few programs out there that do it on a consistent basis.
And it can be very dangerous as well.
If they can pull it off, good for them. And clearly there is a need to reach a younger audience, and especially a younger multi-ethnic audience. One of the things I thought was really funny, though, Amy, when some of the interviews they were giving, they have to be very careful about being perceived by that target audience as authentic, because you have a lot of young Hispanic Americans who basically say, I don't want to be targeted for my ethnic group. So now they're saying, oh, we're not really targeting Hispanics. We're winking at Hispanics, but we're targeting a broader group of young people. That doesn't really sound like what their initial intent was, but they have to be very careful in how they describe to that audience why they're trying to reach out the way they are.
I mean, it's basically a niche program, and it's niche programming around news and content. And I think you're going to see more and more of this, especially if this takes off, because this is the way in which this generation gets their news from. They don't get everything from one place. They get it from various places. And I think this may be ABC and Disney's attempt at getting a piece of that pie.
I mean, I hope they succeed. I hope they succeed and that others can learn some lessons from them. They have a much better chance at succeeding than Al Jazeera America.
I agree.
Not because of content, but because of a lot of other political factors.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens there. That music means we're just about out of time. Thanks to you for listening and watching. There's more background for today's topics on our links blog under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. You can also replay the show and leave comments for us there, or send us an email at views@kbia.org. RJI's Travis McMillan directs our show, and KBIA's Pat Akers handles the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to listen in next week. We'll have another edition of Views of the News.